Well, this is going to be quite the program, and I warn you that if you're disturbed by scary things and don't want to hear them, turn it off now, because this is going to be scary. Gary Ridenour attended Hiram College, and was at Woodstock and the Kent State shootings. He attended medical school in Guadalajara, Mexico, was one of the main characters in the movie Bad Medicine, written by a classmate. He ran his own clinic for the poor out of a Catholic church clinic, sometimes sat and read up on a problem with the patient in the room. Dr. Ridenour did his internship in Regina, Saskatchewan, and then moved on to St. Louis for his residency in internal medicine. Later, he set up the Critical Care Fellowship Program and was the first fellow. After training, Dr. Ridenour ran the emergency room, that would be a biggie, at St. Louis City Hospital, where he saw a murder a day, a rape a day, two gunshots to the chest a day. God. In 1975, he set up the first freestanding rape treatment center at City Hospital and was Citizen of the Year in 1980. He decided to go west in 80 and arrived in Fallon, Nevada, right here in Nevada in 1981. During the Reagan years, Naval Air Station Fallon grew into the premier fighter weapons school in the world and boasts of being the home to Top Gun. Dr. Ridenour has been heavily engaged in the leukemia cluster in Fallon and has co-authored four papers on that subject. He probably is the only citizen in the U.S. who can say he turned an aircraft carrier toward home, made sure everyone got antiviral medications on the way. His current interest is in educating everyone on the threat of the avian flu. And one last time, this is going to be rough stuff. But if you want to hear the truth, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Dr. Ridenour, welcome back to Coast AM.
Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm quite well, thank you. And I wonder, first of all, thank you for sending me the book.
You're welcome.
That's how all this began. I wonder if it's possible to start by actually having you describe what a virus is. I mean, most people know virus causes a cold, virus causes the flu, and what's a virus?
Well, actually, there are about 80 families of viruses, and 20 families of the virus family infect human beings, and they're classified as viral A, B, and C. A is the bad one, B is a little bit and not so bad, C has never infected humans. There are about, you could probably line up 30 million viruses to 1 inch. That's really how small they are. They're about 100 nanometers in diameter, which is a millionth of a millimeter. And they come in rods and crystals and helixes and polyhedrons and filaments and spheres. And the spherical one is the most common for human beings. The problem is that they're very, very special because they're very small. They may be considered the most advanced parasite in the world because they have no locomotion, they have no metabolism, they do not have to go out and find food. The only thing they do is infect and replicate and go out and infect and replicate again. So It's basically they're the ideal parasite.
Okay. We've got this horrible thing in front of us. I'll tell you what, before I even get to that, is there a difference that you can describe between, say, the common flu, the rhinovirus, and this horrid virus we're going to talk about tonight? Is there a difference that one could actually talk about?
Yeah, there's quite a difference with the avian flu, especially what we call H5N1, which is the designation, which we'll talk about later. But regular flu viruses come, follow the rule of parasites, which is rule number one is you don't kill your host. You just spread and move on. The avian flu currently is killing about 60% of the people who come in contact with it. And we hope we don't hope, but we think it's going to mutate down to maybe 10% before it really becomes a pandemic. The problem is with this virus is that once it gets into our lungs and into the cells in our lungs, our immune system looks at the virus, overreacts, and actually dissolves our lungs. Dissolves your lungs. You'll start coughing blood up, which will actually be your own blood and lung tissue. And you can be gone in about 8 hours.
Why does this virus cause this overreaction? I mean, we get other viruses, a cold or, you know, another standard Asian flu, and we don't overreact. We get sick, but we don't overreact. What's different that causes this?
Well, this one, it's called antigenic shift. In other words, it has its structure is immune systems look at things like a virus and read the structure of the virus and then decide what they're going to do with it and how they're going to get rid of it. When it sees the structure of the avian flu virus, it looks at it as being an ultimate foreign body and just attacks it, and then as a result causes what we call a cytokine storm, which is a trigger of a whole bunch of chemicals released to go after the virus, which unfortunately kills the surrounding lung cells also.
So what kills you is your own body's reaction to the virus.
Your immune system kills you. That's true. And for that reason, the death rate is highest between age 20 to 40 because they have the best immune system.
Oh, my God. So those with compromised, normally you hear people with compromised immune systems, the young and the old, need to get flu shots because they are the most vulnerable.
Well, that was true. You know, CDC last year came out and made a statement that after 20 years of handing out the flu vaccine, they hadn't reduced the death rate for people over 55. And they said maybe we should be giving it to the children so that they won't spread it on to other people. And then they backtracked this year and said, it cut down the number of people that were admitted to hospitals in a 55 and older, so we should still be giving it. So there was quite a bit of hocus pocus about, you know, our current vaccine. Plus, the current vaccine is always a year behind what the current virus is.
Okay, that doesn't make any sense to me. If the flu vaccine works, then it should cut down the numbers for people above age 55 or 65 or whatever, as it would for others, right?
Well, that was the original theory was to give it to people over the age of 55 so that the flu wouldn't trip off their other disease problems becoming worse and
right.
having them die.
Right.
After 20 years of looking at it, last year they said, we don't think that's really what's happening. And so because when you get your flu shot this year, you're not really getting the virus that's going to be coming around that year. 2 years ago, I had my flu shot, spent 5 days in the hospital with the flu. And because the virus was different than what the vaccine was made for.
What do you know about this year's?
You know, once again, we're having a problem with the vaccine. There's a lot of controversy with the vaccine. Our biggest problem is that our current method for making the flu vaccine is 50 years old and requires us to take a chicken egg that's fertilized, put a little hole in it, put the virus in it, patch the hole, let the virus grow, then take the virus out and then purify it and make sure it's not active and then make a vaccine out of it. And there was last year or the year before, they had trouble with a lot of eggs and had to throw them out, and the vaccine was late getting, you know, out to the market. The problem is with the avian flu virus is that you put it into the egg, it kills the egg.
It kills the egg.
Yeah, so the whole idea of using eggs is out the window with this one.
All right. Well, many of us have heard a lot of things about the avian flu. For example, there was a story going around, a caller mentioned it. Kimchi was thought to be some sort of defense. Right or wrong?
I really doubt it. I'd say wrong. The It would be like anything else, is that if kimchi really worked and somebody had some good studies to show it would work, the big pharmaceutical companies would be selling kimchi pills today.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. A few years ago, avian flu was in confined to two countries. And what's today? 80 countries?
80 to 90, something, right? We've lost count. It's reappeared. I mean, if you go into, like, use your browser and put an alert on there to look for the word avian flu or bird flu every day, and you'll get an email that shows you things all over the world that there's new outbreaks here, there's new outbreaks there. China just came back out again and said, we've got another outbreak again, but of course, the Chinese have claimed that they've only lost six people due to the flu.
Mm-hmm.
And when the first two countries came out and said, you know, we've got the flu, then the Chinese finally came out and said, oh, yeah, we've had it too for 6 years now. And, well, in a communist country, that, you know, you have to get together and vote on that, you know. So it's like everybody in favor of six, put your hand up. So we don't know how many years it's been in China, but they have thrown everything against it, and the virus has mutated.
All right. Well, the CDC, which is traditionally very conservative, has actually said the avian flu is the greatest threat to mankind in the history of the world.
Yes.
They really said that.
That is true. And there have been previous flu pandemics before. Unfortunately, this virus, this avian flu virus, its ability to mutate and fight and defeat antivirals means that it is a fantastic threat to mankind. We got a glimpse of what happened in 1918 when the avian flu broke out in 1918 and killed 50 to 100 million people.
That was the avian flu?
Yeah, what happened was they used to call it the Spanish flu.
Right.
And we haven't heard much about it until the bird flu or the avian flu just started appearing again. And what they did a number of years ago is that researchers went up into way up in northern Alaska and dug up an Inuit tribe.
I remember that, yes.
Then they were buried in permafrost, and they recovered lung tissue and brought the virus back and found out that it was a bird flu. And unfortunately, the CDC has now reactivated that virus, which is currently the deadliest virus in the history of mankind. And they're going around handing it out to laboratories for them to test it.
You're kidding.
No. And last year, there were 343 laboratory accidents in those super Andromeda strain controlled laboratories. And with everybody in spacesuits, they had 343 accidents last year.
Doctor, the bird flu, and I'm sure a lot of people in the audience have heard the reports, appears to pop up here and there in Asia mostly, although I guess it's in Europe and all over the place now, but not human to human transmission. That's really what we're worried about, right?
That's true. The we have this year at least three clusters that we know of that appear to be human to human. The problem is that they're in undeveloped countries, and by the time everybody gets there and starts looking around, things are pretty well, you know, covered up or have disappeared. The main reason is that Indonesia is probably one of the worst ones. Indonesia, every other month, decides not to let anyone see their virus anymore because they're afraid that we'll find that they have a virus that is mutated human to human, and they don't want to be the first country in the world to be quarantined, which would be an economic disaster.
Is it even possible?
That it'll go human to human?
No, to quarantine a country.
Well, in theory, let's say that. But, you can't stop people from moving things in and out of countries, and it would probably be financially very tough on them, but we just can't quarantine anything. A couple of years ago, the U.S. government finally realized that we were still shipping F-16 jet parts to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we just found that out 2 years ago. We were still sending them equipment.
All right. Something you said at the beginning of the program was one of the first things for a virus, a lethal virus like this, is not to kill the host. This would appear right. to violate that tenet.
Yeah, that's the problem is that the 1918 avian flu had a death rate of maybe 5 to 10%. Currently, this avian flu, with a death rate of 60%, isn't going to go into a pandemic because of the fact that people will go down and die so quickly that it won't be spread.
Like you have a little brush fire and it burns itself out.
Yeah, it burns itself out right away. I mean, you're sick in the morning and you're dead by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Their fear is that, and then what they're watching for is to see if this flu will start to drop its death rate down so that it can be more infectious.
Are there any indications of that yet?
Yeah, there's a couple of cases, I believe in Turkey, Afghanistan, and somewhere else where they believe that it hit families. And in the family, let's say there's about 6 people, and only 2 out of 6 died. And they went like, ooh, theoretically, you know, there should have been a lot more dead. Maybe this flu has mutated. And so, you know, they've looked at that one, those cases, and you know, they're starting to get a feeling that it may start to mutate down.
A pandemic, by definition, is what?
Basically, this is an infection of all countries in the world. An epidemic is an infection in your country or in your area. Pandemic means, you know, it's all over everywhere. And there's been lots of them in history before. And so it's not very surprising that it's going to happen again. But the problem is today is that once we have a pandemic, the industrialized countries or the countries that are more advanced will take the hardest hit.
With the densest population?
Well, the most the countries that are most developed will have to take the hardest hit.
Why?
Well, for example, like in the United States, there may be 100 million people in the United States that have never camped outside, they've never started a fire or anything. When this virus hits, they will be shoved beyond the Stone Age. They will not know how to cook. They will not know how to catch an animal. They will not know how to stay warm. They're totally dependent on the infrastructure. 1918, people... banking was done by hand, mail was delivered by hand, people still had wood-burning stoves, they could still go out and kill a chicken and things or whatever, and that's not today. We got ATMs, we're totally dependent on our electricity, we're just completely lost if we lose these things.
All right. There are people out there who say, the bird flu scare is a hoax. I don't know if you've run into them.
Oh, yes.
But there are people who believe it's just a hoax to scare people, to sell drugs, whatever the reason is. They think it's a hoax. What do you say to those people?
Well, in fact, I got a couple of emails from people that it's part of the conspiracy, the New World Order, and it's a hoax and so on. Quite frankly, in my book, I have the government plan, the National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza. And if you read our government plan, it is so crappy and hokey that you have to understand that this is not a hoax, that these people think that this plan is really going to work. You know, it's stockpiling vaccines and...
No, that's a plan for dealing with
right.
it. I'm saying there are people who think that just the fact that you're saying that the bird flu exists and will become a pandemic... The whole thing's a hoax. There's no bird flu. There's nothing to worry about.
I sincerely hope that whoever's saying that they absolutely are correct on this. Unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that with all the research, all of the world being done, this is not a hoax. This is the real deal.
Not. All right. Doctor, hold tight. We'll be right back from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Okay, let's clear something up right away. I'm told I may be mispronouncing the doctor's name. Dr. Gary C. Ridenour?
Ridenour, yeah, that's it.
Ridenour.
I'm easy, though.
No, let me try it again. Ridenour, is that correct?
Yep, that's it.
Okay, Ridenour. Very good. Doctors, stand by. Back to the bird flu pandemic that's coming in a moment. Dr. Ridenour, we hear about millions of poultry being slaughtered in different parts of the world. I think they just slaughtered many, many in Europe. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. In fact, in Europe last year, or actually this year, they killed so much poultry that the grocery stores reported that they had about a 20% drop in income last year because of loss of revenue because there was no poultry to sell.
Wow. And again, you say that in two countries, it has mutated to a human-to-human a form of the virus. Is that for real? I mean, are we guessing?
Well, they've said by the numbers, by the time, like I said, they get there, for example, in Pakistan, there was, I believe, a number of brothers. One was a veterinarian. He got sick and then passed it on to two other brothers who died, and they hadn't been in contact with anyone with the bird flu. And they were quite concerned that this may have been a straight person-to-person transmission. Unfortunately, by the time everyone got there, the dead had been buried, and that was the end of it. Our problem is today is that so far in the entire world, I think we've only had about two autopsies of people who have died with the bird flu because of cultural and, you know, distance problems and things like that.
Uh-huh. You're saying the pandemic, bird flu pandemic, is inevitable, not a matter of if, but a matter of when. Why do you say that?
Well, it's because of the ability of this virus to mutate in the way it goes about killing people. They compare it to the 1918 avian flu pandemic, look at this one, and said, you know, it's no longer an if, it's now a when. One other group has quoted that the probability is one chance in three of it becoming a pandemic. It's just that it doesn't stop. It just keeps coming. It's not seasonal anymore. At first, they thought it was going to go with the migratory bird patterns. That's not happening anymore. It's moving with commerce. A form of the bird flu appeared in England earlier this year, and they shut it. It actually went human to human, but it just made the people, you know, sick with the like flu symptoms, and they thought they had it completely contained and said, wow, we've done it. The next thing you know, it's in West Virginia, and then Virginia, and then now it's in Canada. So it's moving with commerce. We also have problems with, there's a lot of people in the world who smuggle birds.
Right.
And bird smuggling, a lot of these birds are sick. So they smuggle them around, and we have no way of controlling that either. But, yeah, all the experts, especially Dr. Michael Osterholm, who, if you go on the Internet and look up CIDRAP, C-I-D-R-A-P, they follow it very, very closely, the University of Minnesota. And he's kind of the prophet. 4 or 5 years ago, he was saying, this is bad. This is not good. A year or so on the news, they had somebody from WHO and somebody from the CDC, and they quoted Osterholm, and Osterholm, they said, you know, 2 years ago we thought this guy was crazy. Now we look to him as being the prophet, that he was on target a number of years ago.
Well, for the CDC to quote it as the biggest threat to mankind, I guess in history, that's just an amazing statement to make.
Well, it is, and this virus, we have lots of other viruses, but this is not like this one. In fact, a very surprising thing just happened about a week ago is that I believe it was Missouri or Mississippi, I think Mississippi, they had a number of pigs that became ill, and they found that they had a virus. They looked at the virus, and it was a pig virus which had picked up the avian flu virus, and that avian flu virus mutated with the pig virus.
Wow.
And that's the first time that's been seen before. And they've done a lot of studies to see whether or not it would transmit human to human, and it hasn't. The problem is that the pig is a virus cooker. Pigs are quite physiologically similar to human beings. And so viruses cook in pigs and often go from a pig to a human, and then the flu will take off. So this was a big surprise. Every time we look at one area and we think everyone's got kind of a handle on what's going on, then we turn around and now we got a bird pig virus that's popped up.
Doctor, how quickly could this develop and spread?
A good example is that the Pakistanis I was talking about, one brother was from New York City, flew to Pakistan and buried two of his brothers, and flew back to New York and didn't feel well at all and went to an emergency room and was immediately isolated because they were afraid that he may have contracted the bird flu and had, you know, they were afraid that he was on two or three different airplanes. The people in those planes had gone off to other airplanes.
Right.
And within a day or two, you would have 10 or 15,000 people already, you know, contaminated. So it would move very fast. The Osterholm says that when it hits the United States, if it's really going to be as bad as we think it is, we will be out of caskets in the first week. The first week, we will not have any caskets. One, the caskets will be used up is one. Two, the people that make the caskets will be dead, sick, or staying home. The supplies for the caskets won't be there. That was one of the problems in 1918 is that the survivors of the flu had their lifespan reduced by almost 15 years because of the amount of damage done to their organs.
Primarily lungs or what?
Yeah, lungs and things like that. My my uncle had asthma-like symptoms for the rest of his life after he had the avian flu. And subsequently, at a very young age, had a flu attack in Kansas City. And he was in a drugstore, and he ran back to the bathroom. And unfortunately, it was stairway to the basement, and he broke his neck.
I see.
But there were a lot of other people that, like I said, that were incapacitated. It ended the First World War. I mean, that's just to give you an idea of how bad it was. In less than a year, it stopped the First World War.
Ebola is an interesting virus. It does the same thing we were talking about earlier, right? It's so lethal, it just burns out.
Yeah, that's the thing is that the Ebola is the same thing. It gets loose in one area. It just kills the whole village, and
right.
It's over. But our little avian friend
What I want to ask is, why do you feel that the avian flu will mutate in the way you've described and Ebola has not yet done so, or may not?
Well, the Ebola is more of a hemorrhagic fever, and the morphology, the structure of the Ebola virus is very different than the physical structure of the bird flu virus.
Okay.
And for that reason, it doesn't have the characteristics to mutate as much as our bird flu friend.
I see. All right. What about defenses against it? For a while, we heard that Tamiflu might work against it. Does it?
We just had some problems with Tamiflu. First off, resistance is almost one-third of the patients just with normally with the flu. In China, Tamiflu did not work at all. Just recently in Japan, they've been using a lot of Tamiflu, and they had four teenagers commit suicide from one dose of Tamiflu because of unbelievable hallucinations when they took the Tamiflu. And so they've taken a big step back on Tamiflu now and said, you know, this is probably not going to work.
But that said, again, is it possibly effective against bird flu or not?
Right now, the answer is no. Mm-hmm. And we've got Flumidine, which is another one, and Relenza, which is another one.
Oh, yes.
And it's, you know, the Tamiflu manufacturers are in Europe, and they pulled back delivering Tamiflu to the United States for a while and said, we're going to keep it all in one big pile. And when the flu breaks out, then we're going to send all that antiviral medicine to that one country to control it. That would be a complete chaos. I mean, you'd be paying $200 for a Tamiflu tablet because, you know, it would be hijacked right away and only the rich would get the medication. And currently, it's not the drug of choice. Even on your website today, you had a mention of a new vaccine that's coming out. And that new vaccine is, I think it's AccuFlu A, I think it is, by Aventis Corporation. Mm-hmm. And you look around on this one and you go, whoa, new flu vaccine that could be good against A and B. And you read the results, and I read four or five different articles, and they've only used it on 72 people. And I said, oh, wow, it looks pretty good. And then I found that it has a safe harbor statement with it now that says that forward-looking statements like may, will, could, forecast, expects, predicts, so on and so forth, are really not fair because further research may be unpredictable. In other words, don't really put too much weight into what we're talking about right now.
From the time you're exposed to H5N1 to the moment you begin getting sick, it would be how long?
Well, H5N1 was the 1918, and it came in three waves. And it came out of, for some reason, we think it came out of Asia, but where it really started cooking was in Kansas, and in the military bases in Kansas. And it got over to, it went from Fort Lewis, and then it rode with the trains with the troops. And, of course, in those days, they shipped the chickens live until they were processed because they really didn't have a good way of freezing them and so forth in 1918. So the chicken containers went all over the country and things. Within a day or two of being exposed in 1917, people were starting to get sick. They called it the three-day flu. And then the second and third wave hit. By spring 1918, you could go down, you could be dead in just a few days.
Okay, when you say waves, you're talking about waves. So, I don't know, you and I are in Nevada, for example.
Right.
So if this thing began to move, got going and began to move, you're suggesting it would come through, pass Nevada, get however many people sick it's going to, and then keep going, and what, go around the world and then back to Nevada, or around the country and back to Nevada, or what?
One of the fears is that this may become the predominant flu for the next 10 or 15 years, that it may come in a wave and then disappear, and the next year come back in a stronger or less strong version.
I see.
And may keep coming in back and forth. And that in 1918, they did note that they started making people in the United States wear a cloth mask, and they didn't have funerals. They didn't want people to get together. They stopped meetings and parades and everything. And they found out that the virus came into a town with a horrible death rate, and within a week to 10 days, it was gone. And so, like I said in my book, is the best theory is that if you can stay indoors for 10 days and stay away from everybody, you got a good chance of surviving it.
At least the first wave. But then another wave.
There's a possibility of another wave. The problem is that the damage to the infrastructure we'll lose power first, electrical power, and because electricity is brokered every day, and the brokers will be dead, sick, or not be able to get to work, or they'll be staying home with their kids because the schools will all be closed. And the people that deliver the fuel or run the plants won't be there. And so, you know, we'll get a rolling blackout that'll take out most of the country. And from there, then, you know, communication goes down.
Very quickly. This country is not at all equipped to live without power.
Well, our power system, our backup systems and designs to catch overloads are over 45 years old. So, I mean, a few years ago in Ohio, we almost came up to within 30 seconds of a massive blackout of the entire East Coast because of an overload.
Really? Yeah, well, there have been. Of course, the East Coast, I was at that great power failure back in New York, the first great power failure. It was awful.
Oh, I was in Ohio, and we thought it was an atomic war or something because...
That's exactly what I thought.
There was no radio, there was no TV, there was no nothing.
That's
and,
right.
You know, we couldn't figure out what was going on.
So you think the, I guess then, also the first responders, those in ambulances, clinic workers, hospital workers, they're going to go first, aren't they?
Yeah, the first thing is that once we lose power, we lose fuel. And if you saw in Oklahoma, when they got hit with that big ice storm, people with big manual pumps trying to pump gasoline or fuel out of the ground so that they could take it to the water department so they could keep the pumps running so they could keep up water pressure. And so, you know, without power, we don't have fuel. And your first responders go, 80% of our drugs for hospitals and everybody in the United States come from other countries. That stuff won't be coming. When the power goes out, all of our aircraft navigate by radio signals from the ground.
Right.
They won't be able to get around because there won't be any power. So that goes down the chutes. So there's no medication. The outside of the hospitals will have lines of people trying to get in who are sick. Only the ones that are coughing up blood or will actually be brought in. They will be given morphine to make them comfortable until they pass away. And like England has already picked out buildings to use as temporary mortuaries. And then once the buildings are full, they're going to set them on fire and burn them.
Oh my God!
And
this is actually a written plan.
Yeah, it's actually goes back to the 1962 plan in England of what to do after an atomic attack, what to do with the bodies.
Yeah.
Hong Kong is already set up to use their stadiums as field hospitals. You know, a lot of countries have set up real plans for this. The problem is that when we run out of morphine for these people, then what do we do next? Do we dispatch them with a pistol, or what do we do? Furthermore, with no power, after a while, generators are horribly inefficient, and so pretty soon you don't have any fuel for the generator either.
Right. Right, but you said that if you were able to isolate yourself for, what did you say, 10?
8 to 10 days.
8 to 10 days.
Yeah, it's a kind of a joke in my office that people come in and go, you know, the flu bug's loose here in town. And I went, yep, and if we all stay home for a week, it would be gone.
You're still in practice. What kind of practice do you have, doctor?
Well, originally I was internal medicine and critical care. After 25 years in rural Nevada, I see everything from babies on up. So it's more like country medicine.
They do a flu report on CNN, and it seems like I think Nevada right now is in sort of the sporadic category. Is that accurate?
It is, and it depends where you're at, too. Our problem in Fallon is that we have about 13,000 men and women that come through the Navy base every year. So you could be getting a sore throat on an aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean, and 3 days later you're coughing in a casino in Fallon.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, so our waves are quite different than what we get here. But it usually comes in the regular flu virus usually comes in the winter because the mutation of the virus happens over in Asia, which at that time of the year, it's their spring. So it's their spring there, and it's our winter here, and the virus is on its way.
I've always been curious about why it all seems to come out of Asia and probably Southeast Asia more than anything else. So we'll address that when we get back. We're going into a break. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.